Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's great. That sounds terrific. Thank you.
The topic, genetically modified foods, are they killing you? Many believe genetically modified foods have the potential to solve many of the world's hunger and malnutrition problems and to help protect and preserve the environment by increasing yield and reducing reliance upon chemical pesticides and herbicides. Yet there are many challenges ahead for governments, especially in the area of safety testing, regulation, international policy, and food labeling. Many feel genetic engineering is the inevitable wave of the future and that we cannot afford to ignore a technology that has such enormous potential benefits. However, we must proceed with caution to avoid causing unintended harm to human health and the environment as a result of our enthusiasm for this powerful technology. Well, that's where we're going to begin tonight. Some think it's a good thing, and some say slow down, not so fast. But before we begin, we want to remind you that tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. Also, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. Well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, let me introduce my guest tonight. I've got some very smart people who are very well-read on this topic, so it should be a very interesting show, like I said earlier. First, we have Dr. Amy L. Dean. She's president of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. And also we have with us Dr. Fred Kirschman. He's a longtime national and international leader in sustainable agriculture. He's a professor at Iowa State, and he also manages his family's 2,600-acre organic farm in central North Dakota. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Great, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming. For those who are listening who may not have a clue as to what genetically modified foods are, can you all explain what that is? We'll start with you, Amy. What is genetically modified foods?
Well, it's a method of actually taking DNA material from one organism and introducing it into another organism. Usually occurs randomly. I think one of the most common examples is taking DNA from a bacterial toxin or pesticide DNA and randomly inserting it into corn DNA to try to produce some resistance. And usually the process is done using either a method of infecting the cells or blasting in the genetic material with a gene gun, and in hopes that it will somehow incorporate within the gene and take up the desired property of the pesticide resistant property or whatever property they're looking to incorporate into the plant.
Okay. When was this first put on the market? When did this first hit the market?
You know, I think it was in the late 1990s is when it first came out.
Okay. Dr. Kirschman, why are GM foods produced? Why do we have them in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think the primary reason that they got introduced is because it simplified the management for farmers. And, you know, farmers are under enormous pressure now to produce as much as possible, as efficiently as possible, so that not only to meet the demands, increasing demands as we're now particularly using grain crops for not only for food and for fiber, but now also for energy. And so farmers are under enormous pressure to produce as much as possible, and the best way to do that is to specialize. So most farmers now only raise one or two crops or one species of animals, and to simplify their management, and that's where the genetic engineering crops come in, because it, when you use a seed that has that's genetically engineered to resist Roundup, then you can plant thousands of acres of soybeans, for example, and then wait until the weeds come up, and then you spray it with Roundup, and it kills the weeds, and then you solve the problem, and so you can cover a lot more acres. And then, economies of scale, of course, is the other factor that enables them to do what we've asked them to do.
Okay. Dr. Dean, would you agree with that answer?
Yeah, actually, as a medical clinician, we're looking more at the health effects through the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, and really don't have a background in farming methods.
Okay. Are GM foods assessed differently from traditional foods?
As far as I know, and maybe this is a question for Dr. Krishman. It's they're passed off as having as being identical, and the term that is often used is substantial equivalence, meaning that it's just substantially equivalent to the food that is already in existence, you know, in composition and in nutritional value. And unfortunately, we're seeing that this is not the case in the animal studies, that there are harmful effects that we're seeing. And interestingly, on a macro level, we do see maybe that they look alike, but if you're looking biochemically and genetically, they're very different.
Really? Dr. Kirschman, would you like to answer that one?
Yeah, no, that's exactly correct. And my understanding is that when it's determined that a food is substantially equivalent to another food, then FDA is not under any obligation to test it.
How are the potential risks to human health determined?
Fortunately, there have been a lot of independent researchers who are doing some great research, and they're doing third generational animal studies and looking at reproductive issues and what's going on with the genetics and the organs of these animals, through the generations, and that's really where we're starting to just see the problems that are interestingly similar in different studies. There's a lot of overlap in the animal data that we're seeing in the different studies, and there's a lot of overlap with what we're seeing in the animal studies and what we're seeing in human epidemics in the human population.
I'd like to ask both of you, are you all pro GM foods or against GM foods? Dr. Kirschman.
I'm basically against the way they're currently being used. I think that's the key problem. And I'm always reluctant to simply condemn a technology because it may not be working out well. I think that the kind of challenges we're going to be facing, we need all of the options on the table. But the way we're currently using them is not sustainable because we're basically using the transgenic technologies in the same way that we use the chemical technologies, and that is what Joe Lewis, who was pest management specialist with the Agriculture Research Service, called single tactic therapeutic intervention. In other words, you have a pest problem, and then you come in from outside with a pesticide to get rid of the pest. And that never works because you never get rid of all of the target pests, so you actually build pest resistance. And you, in the process, you destroy some other organisms that previously helped to keep pests in check. And so you in fact create a pest resurgence. And so that's the problem. You in effect, end up creating the problem that you're trying to solve. I think that if we used genetic knowledge to better understand how systems function and then manage those systems in ways that would reduce pests, and there's a lot of research about how to do that, I would be very in favor, very much in favor of that kind of use of genetic research.
Dr. Dean, your website, aaemonline.org, it says that GM foods pose a serious health risk in the area of toxicology, allergy, and immune function, reproductive health, and metabolic, physiologic, and genetic health, and are without benefit. You agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I was one of the co-authors of the position paper and spent a lot of time culling through the data and really looking at what the researchers were finding in the independent data. And these were well-controlled studies. And what we're seeing in a lot of the studies is a lot of disruption in the immune system. Some studies are showing that, especially in like the old and young populations of mice, There's pretty significant changes in white blood cell count. Some of them suppress the white blood cell count, which would make the population more at risk for infection. There are various studies that are showing there is a definite connection with infertility, which is also an epidemic, among humans. And there are just significant areas that we're seeing, that are being reported in the animal studies that are also concerns in the human population. So that would also include in the animal studies they're seeing changes in the genetics of how the genes are being expressed in animals that eat genetically modified food, and it's causing changes in how their DNA is expressed for cholesterol metabolism, sugar metabolism, or insulin metabolism. And, in this country right now, we're having an epidemic of diabetes and of, high cholesterol, heart disease. And one of the concerns that the American Academy of Environmental Medicine has is that, what we're seeing in the human population is actually occurring when you look at the animal populations that are being fed GMO foods, and that there might be a correlation between the two.
Didn't you all, or your site, didn't it have a precautionary approach? What is you all's precautionary approach to what should happen?
Right. Yeah, so the precautionary principle actually has been used quite a bit in public and environmental health, and the idea behind that, there are different definitions that listeners, could look up on the web if they were to Google that, but basically what it says is to protect the health of people and the environment. If there are potential threats that are irreversible or potential technology that could be damaging to environment or health, that we need to be cautious and we need to have more evidence, and we should not put the environment or the health of the population at risk. In the event that these are dangerous, and we're just not, we're just not able to show that cause. So based on what we're seeing in the animal data, which is interesting because animal data is often cited in the traditional medical literature. If you go to a cardiology, like a national cardiology conference, they'll talk about the animal data and how certain drugs, were effective in the animal studies and things like that. So the animal data in medicine is very important, and what we're seeing here with the changes in the health effects in the animal population, AEM, the Environmental Medicine Academy, believes that we should be cautious and take steps to protect public health, which included calling for a moratorium on genetically modified foods.
I think the last thing I'm going to mention from your site that I found very interesting is that you all felt like instead of, I guess, if I'm understanding correctly what it meant, is that you all feel like instead of, I guess, something happening and then the government acting, that the proponents should be, the burden of proof should lie on them. Is that what I understand you all to say?
Well, no, actually, we're not saying that. We're calling on the use of the precautionary principle, and in the precautionary principle, it actually calls for that the Rio Declaration from 1992, that and then there was another United States definition from 1998 from environmental health meetings that said burden of the burden of proof should be on industry, not on the public.
I agree 100%. Would you agree with that, Dr. Kirschman?
Yeah, the other thing about the precautionary principle is that if there's evidence of potential harm, then instead of proceeding with that, you should be looking for alternatives. So there's actually an incentive for innovation built into it. And in countries in Europe where they're applying the precautionary principle, that's actually working out that way. So a lot of people say, well, you can't do the precautionary principle because it would be too harmful to business. But it's not working out that way where they're applying it.
I was just going to make the point that with the precautionary principle, that Dr. Kirschman is absolutely right. And I was talking to a physician who does a lot of environmental endocrine disruption work, Dr. Ted Shetler, and his point also has been that when you're using the precautionary principle, obviously it takes a lot of courage to do that, but we do that every day in medicine. When we see a patient and we're trying to screen them and to see if they might have a heart attack, we don't wait till a person has a heart attack to start intervening. We intervene before that, so it's actually something that's used on a very day-to-day basis that many healthcare providers are very familiar with.
So I brought up the point that if you're a Muslim or you're a Jew or you're a vegetarian, that they may not wish to have their food altered this way as far as the gene changes. Do you think that you agree with that? That, you know, if you're someone who's like has religious beliefs about certain things or a vegetarian, that you may not want to deal with this genetically altered food?
Well, I think it goes beyond that, actually. I think, you know, just as on a worldwide scale and a planetary scale, everybody has the right to good health, you know, and even beyond the scope of religion, you know, I think what we're seeing in the animal studies, I don't think anybody, and should be subjected to the disease processes that we're seeing in the animal studies, you know.
Let's ask this question because I'm very confused. How much testing has been done? Because I understand there's three different agencies that oversee this. What are those agencies, Dr. Kirschman?
Well, I'm not an expert in that, but obviously the Food and Drug Administration has responsibilities. It would have the primary responsibilities in terms of food. And then you've got the APHIS, part of USDA that has a responsibility in terms of, you know, whether or not there's harm to other plant organisms. I don't know what the third one would be. But
that was Dr. Dean. What is the third one?
You know, I'm not familiar with the different agencies. Sometimes the USDA or the Agriculture Department.
There's actually three, which I didn't understand, which of course causes confusion when you have that many agencies involved with, you know, ruling over one, you know, particular issue. But I understood that. I think it was the USDA, the FDA, and I forgot what the third one is, but I'll find it in a second. But there are three different agencies that they have monitoring that. But as far as actually what's happening, there aren't any really strict regulations on GM foods here, from what I understand.
Absolutely. That's why I think the big concern with the American Academy of Environmental Medicine, called for the moratorium, called for, you know, immediate long-term independent safety testing, epidemiological studies, work with the independent scientific community, because there's absolutely no data. And people often do refer to it as kind of a science experiment that we don't really know what the outcome is going to be because we're not monitoring.
This morning at 6 a.m., I got a wake-up call from Marco Cantiro out of Belgium, and I'd asked him to be a part of the program, but right now it's 4 a.m. in Belgium, so he wasn't able to be on the panel. But we had a lengthy conversation about this topic, and he told me something that really surprised me. He said that as of today, to his knowledge, there's over 200,000 Indian farmers that have committed suicide over genetically modified food seed. Are you all familiar with that?
Well, Vandana Shiva has been monitoring that, and I don't know that it's accurate to say that they've committed suicide specifically over genetically or transgenic crops. What it is that they have been encouraged to adopt industrial practices, which often includes that, and then suddenly they have to buy herbicides, which they didn't buy before. They have to buy expensive seeds, which they didn't buy before, and then they go into debt, and they can't get out of debt, and then they often actually commit suicide by drinking pesticides.
And that sounds like such an extreme. I mean, but that just tells you that they must be under enormous pressure over there to keep up with what's going on. What I understood about this particular story is that basically they were almost forced to, and then they borrowed money from loan companies with a high interest rate, and when their crops fell, these seeds that they were promised to bring them these incredible harvests didn't. And so when that happened, they were without any way to pay back the loans. And so therefore, they felt like they had no way out, so they committed suicide. And this, I mean, from what I found, and I found some information on DailyMail.com, that they were committing suicide at a rate of over 1,000 suicides a month. That's incredible. And that was as of 2008, and that was reporting 125,000 then. And Marco this morning said it's over 200,000 now.
So yeah, I don't know the exact statistics on that, but that could very well be.
Yeah, and I understand the Vatican has voiced concerns about it, as well as the Prince of Wales, that there's issues with genetically modified foods that need to be addressed, and obviously it hasn't been addressed yet, but I just wanted to mention that. And thank Marco Cantero for calling this morning. And another thing that I found interesting is that other countries, there's other regions that have issues with genetically modified foods, and they're talking about it. In India, there are no GM foods grown there, from what I understand. Are you all familiar with that?
In the entire country of India, there isn't?
India has no GM crops grown there, and no GM products are commercially available in their supermarkets. I saw that also in some states in Brazil have banned GM crops entirely. The Brazilian Institute for Defense of Consumers, in collaboration with Greenpeace, has filed suit to prevent the importation of GM crops. You know, which poses another question. The importation of crops, there's no regulation on that either, from what I understand. Which is amazing to me that we are just moving food around and nobody's, you know, monitoring it in any tight regulations at all. I just found that absolutely fascinating. But that was just something I wanted to mention. And I think Europe also has an anti-GM food. There's some protesters over there that have been especially active. Why are we not hearing anything about it in the States? I know there's groups because I researched quite a few of y'all. But, Dr. Dean, why are we not hearing much about this over here?
You know, it's really hard to say. I think you're right. There hasn't been much coverage, although I think, you know, we're starting to see that change. I think people are starting to wake up and understand that there's a problem, and people are wondering why there's been such a huge increase in chronic disease since, you know, the late 1990s. Around 1997, we started seeing a big change in chronic disease, big increase. Also seeing a huge spike in diabetes. And I think people are wondering, and we're starting to see, you know, different groups and come out and actually, you know, starting to see some more articles and information in more mainstream, you know, health magazines. And, you know, there are some groups that are working very hard to get the message out, like Center for Food Safety and Institute for Responsible Technology. And they actually, for your listeners, have a ton of information. If they go to their websites, they have downloadable, you know, shopping guides and, you know, different things to really help people understand how to shop so that they can avoid the genetically modified foods and really try to raise the awareness so people can make different choices here.
And what website is that?
One is centerforfoodsafety.org, and the other is responsibletechnology.org.
I used the term this morning with Mr. Cantero, Frankenstein foods, and he says, I kind of object to that term. Do you all agree that genetically modified foods can be kind of put in a category with Frankenstein-type foods?
With what kind of foods?
They call them Frankenstein foods. I guess meaning like it's doctored, or, you know, scientists are putting it together in a lab, and then, you know, we're putting it on our food, on our dinner table. So they're calling it Frankenstein foods.
Yeah, I you know, personally, I think those kinds of characterizations are, I don't think that's terribly helpful. I think what we have to do is get, you know, clear information around what, in the first place, I think that, you know, we also need to be careful about, like, when something is safe. You know, one of the you know, there was an article in Science magazine a couple of months ago, which was put together by about six scientists, and was obviously peer-reviewed, and it was basically a justification for transgenic foods. And then in the middle of that article, there was a statement that said, we know it's safe because it's been out there for 13 years.
Wow.
Which is one of the most unscientific statements that you can imagine, and yet it was, you know, peer-reviewed and appeared in one of the most respected scientific journals. And so I think we have to become much more careful about and this is not unusual in the field of agriculture. You know, when Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring came out, the agricultural community scientists almost uniformly, you know, castigated it, said that the claims that she made were not true, et cetera. Well, later on, they had to admit that, you know, that she was right. So we have to be much more cautious, I think, about you know, when we talk about these kinds of technologies, about what's safe and what isn't safe. We have to again, it's a place to where I think we have to where we have to exercise caution. And the important thing is that when we don't know, and with regard to safety, you know, you can, I mean, you know, human organisms are extremely complex, and sometimes it takes a lifetime for, you know, certain kinds of negative things to appear. And, you know, how long did it take the scientific community to reach consensus on smoking? And so, you know, it seems to me that the important thing here, which we haven't done, is labeling. And people ought to have the choice whether or not they want to put that in their bodies or not. And that seems to me that that's the biggest, problem that we have currently.
And that's a good segue. Why are we not labeling genetically modified foods?
Well, technically, the reason we aren't labeling it is because, you know, we've made this claim that it's substantially equivalent. So why would you label something that's substantially equivalent? But clearly, from the point of view of the companies that are producing this technology, they don't want it labeled because they know that would have a negative effect on sales. I mean, over 90%, all of the surveys that have been done indicate that over 90% of the public would like to see genetically engineered foods labeled. But I think one of the things that's going to be something of a game changer, you know, if you're going to drink some Coca-Cola and it has high fructose corn syrup in it, and you don't know whether that corn syrup was from corn that was genetically engineered or not genetically engineered, you're probably not going to care that much. But if you go into a supermarket now and you're going to buy sweet corn, or you're going to buy broccoli, and you don't know, in other words, a whole food, and you don't know whether it's genetically engineered or not, I think that's a different situation, and that's the future that we're moving into now. And so I think there's a real opportunity now get a public movement going for labeling, and I think that we have a much better chance of getting that done now.
If you just tuned in, you've come center stage for the topic, Genetically Modified Foods, Are They Killing You? We're talking with Dr. Amy L. Dean. She's the president of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. And we're also talking with Dr. Frederick Hirschman. He's a professor at Iowa State, and he's also a national and international leader in sustainable agriculture. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by African American News and Commentary Blog, your single source for news, events, and commentary that is of unique interest to African Americans. They're located on the web at www.AfricanAmericanNewsAndCommentary.com. Another thing that Mr. Contreras told me this morning that I found very interesting, there's only 5 companies that are manufacturing these GM seeds. Is that correct?
You know, I don't keep count on it anymore because they keep getting more and more consolidated, but I think that's probably still right now.
Wow. So, I mean, when you take and you close anything down to just a very few, that's never good. I mean, because first of all, you're closing up the competitiveness of it, and then secondly, you're really just allowing a few people to determine what we put on our food table, on our table for dinner, and that's scary. That's absolutely scary. But why do you think the government has allowed, you know, just 5 companies to control the food supply for the world?
Well, you know, to some extent, we're all at fault for that, because for a long time, I think it's starting to the food culture is starting to change now, but for a long time, what do we all want? We wanted our food fast, convenient, and cheap. And so in order to accomplish that, you know, farmers and input suppliers and processing companies and retailers all were focused on producing our food more cheaply and more efficiently. And the way you do that is you specialize, you simplify your management, and you go for economies of scale. And so it's not just, you know, the, what you described is not just about just such a few companies producing genetically modified seeds or the materials. You know, you're talking about the whole food system. I mean, we're at the there's a friend of mine that's been studying this for a long time at the University of Missouri, and he claims that in the not too distant future, there will only be about 4 retail stores that will be in charge of our entire food system.
What? Really? That sounds like the banking system.
Well, it's you know, you can I mean, one of the jokes in places like Iowa now is that the solution for farmers is to get too big to fail.
Wow, that's scary stuff. I mean, you know, we've talked on this show several times about Agenda 21. Some of this sounds like Agenda 21. I don't know if you all are familiar with that, but it really does, because it's controlling the channels that the food come out of. And so if they decide to close these 5 avenues, then suddenly we have no food. Or if they close 2 or 3 of them, then we're down to, you know, just a small amount of people that will be capable of giving us seed. That's scary.
Well, I think the important thing, too, for people to remember is they have a choice to purchase organic food, which is always not genetically modified. And I think that's one important point, because one of the foundations in environmental medicine is that when we see patients who have any disease process, we're looking for the environmental trigger. And oftentimes, you know, patients are eating, you know, food that's very pesticided, and just putting them on an organic diet and getting the pesticides out of their diet can have a significant improvement on their health. So if people understand that they really have a choice, and they can make different choices, that can completely and quickly change the landscape.
Well, the problem with that, though, Dr. Jean, and is that most people can barely afford groceries as it is, and then you say buy organic, that just like doubles the grocery bill.
Well, you know, actually some studies have been done, and it depends on what people are eating. If people will cut out the processed food from their diet, and basically they call it shopping from the outside, so if you're eating, you know, fresh organic fruits and vegetables and, you know, organic meats, and you're not eating a lot of packaged processed food, the cost is very similar, and the benefits are so much outweigh, you know, the conventional diet. And what they're finding in the studies are there are actually more health benefits to organic foods because they're higher in antioxidants and magnesium. So you're actually able to get nutrition into the body that you're not going to get with conventional food.
Okay. Dr. Kirschman, you have a 2,600-acre organic farm. So what is it when people hear the term organic, what can they expect to get from food that's organic? There's no pesticides, there's no herbicides ever on organic produce.
Well, when you ask the question, what do people expect, I can't answer that because I don't know. Different people, I'm sure, you know, expect different things. But there is a national standard for organic that is based on the Organic Foods Production Act, which was passed in 2000, and a whole set of regulations now that rule that. And, you know, if people want to go into the detail on that, all you need to do is you know, get online and, you know, check in with USDA and the National Organic Program, and all of the standards will be outlined. But basically, what the standard requires is that you, in order to be certified organic, you cannot use any synthetic materials in your production system except for those synthetic materials, or in your processing system, except for those that have been approved synthetics. And you can use any natural material except those natural materials which are on the disallowed list, like arsenic is a natural material, and you can't use that. And so, but I think, but to say that there aren't any pesticides in organic food, you know, you can't use any pesticides, but, you know, in nature there's always some drift, and so you're going to have, you know, some very low levels. But again, one of the things that, you know, I was on the National Organic Standards Board when we were developing the rule. And one of the things that a number of us on the board wanted to do was to also require that farmers manage their soil in ways that would restore the and improve the biological health of the soil, because there is a direct connection between the taste of food, and we think, although there hasn't been any real peer-reviewed research done on this yet, that there may also be a connection between healthy soil and the health qualities of food. And someday we're going to do the research on that to either verify it or prove that it's not true. But nevertheless, we felt it was important for that for the health of the soil to be on organic farms to be managed that way. And the National Organic Program was also, you know, in favor of doing that. But when they ran that by the lawyers in USDA, the lawyers said you can't do that because for regulation, you have to be able to answer a regulation with a yes or a no, and there was no way to do that with that kind of complex requirement in terms of how you manage soil, and that's how we ended up with the you can't use synthetic materials, that's a no, you can use natural materials, that's a yes.
Okay, Dr. Dean, what are the issues of concern for the environment? You know, what do we need to be concerned about?
Are you as far as food or just environment in general?
Just the environment.
Yeah, I think with environmental medicine, the really kind of a key take-home point is it's the total load on a person that causes their disease. And what that means is different for every person, every patient. So when we see patients that come in with a disease process, we take an environmental history and we look back sometimes all the way to birth to see what they've been exposed to, what their parents were exposed to, you know, more than just, you know, were there smokers in the home? We ask about pesticide exposure. Were there pesticides sprayed in the home? Did you live in a new home that might have a lot of off-gassing formaldehyde or, you know, volatile chemicals that end up being stored in the body and at a later point in time may cause disease? So basically, and according to the CDC too, it's genes plus environment equals your disease. So kind of whatever is the predisposition genetically plus whatever a person is exposed to results in a disease process. And the key is to kind of figure out what caused it and how to reverse that process. So environmental physicians will often use organic diets. We'll look for food allergies that might be adding to a patient's total load, which is the kind of the sum of total toxic exposures, you know, food allergies, stressors, different things in the environment that may be impacting their health, and try to find ways in to decrease this total load and allow the body to heal.
Okay. Dr. Kirschman, several years ago we started hearing the government saying they were paying farmers not to farm. Is that connected to the GM seeds at all or the genetically modified foods?
No, I don't think it is at all. I mean, they, you know, when we had that farm policy of paying farmers not to farm, what the government was trying to do at that point was to stabilize the prices that farmers were paid. So if supply was exceeding demand, which would, of course, push prices down, then farmers were required to plant less acres and to put, you know, some of their acres in, you know, some of their acres would be left fallow. In the interest of stabilizing the supply and demand, I don't think that had anything to do. And that was before, you know, the development of genetically modified crops.
Do we know what the future developments can be expected in the area of GM foods are, or GMOs? Do we know what future developments can be expected in the area of GMOs?
Well, I don't know how imaginative these folks are still, but you know, one of the things that's being being developed right now, which is of concern to some of us, is you know, the resistance for glyphosate, to which is the material used for Roundup, the resistance to glyphosate on weeds now is developing very rapidly. In fact, one of our weed scientists at Iowa State University has predicted now that if farmers don't change their weed control strategy from just using Roundup, then in another 2 years it will be totally ineffective in terms of raising corn or soybeans in Iowa, you know, using Roundup. And so companies now are developing seeds for resistance to 2,4-D and dicamba. And, in some ways, 2,4-D is probably less toxic to the environment than, depending on, the research that Dr. Aldi was talking about that's currently being explored in terms of what we're finding out about glyphosate. But the problem with it is that 2,4-D is very volatile in terms of leafy plants. And if seeds were developed that are resistant to 2,4-D and you start spraying a lot of that, it would virtually kill the grape industry in states where it's used, because it would destroy grape vineyards. So there's some really serious problems that could be a part of the unintended consequence of this, and those are serious concerns for many of us.
Dr. Jean, we know a lot of women struggle with fibroid tumors. A friend of mine recently went to the doctor, and the doctor told her to completely get off of chicken. And he was explaining that the chicken, I believe if I'm understanding correctly, when they are injected with the hormones, they are injected in the wing of the chicken. And supposedly, from what the doctor explained to her, you cannot cook those hormones out of that chicken. So he advised her to completely leave chicken alone. Have you heard that?
Well, actually, yeah, the growth hormone is another recombinant DNA or genetically modified food that often is sometimes overlooked because it's a little different strain. So a lot of times the growth hormone, the recombinant growth hormone, is in the chicken, but it's also in the milk products because it's used on dairy cattle and things like that too. So things such as fibroids or breast cancer, things like that, that are sensitive to growth hormone. Growth hormone is known throughout the medical literature to be linked with increased rates of cancer, and it can stimulate cancer growth. So one recommendation for patients who are at a higher risk for breast cancer would be to eliminate any products from their diet that would expose them to growth hormone.
So chicken, and are you saying beef that isn't organic and fish? What are you talking about?
Yeah, the beef dairy products. To my knowledge, it's not used in the fish industry. I don't believe it's allowed to be used in sheep or goat either. So I don't believe their products have any recombinant growth hormone in there too. So mainly it's the chicken products and the dairy products.
Wow.
Yeah, growth. Growth hormones are not allowed in any organic production.
Really?
Right,
so
exactly.
So anytime you go into the supermarket and you see organic chicken or organic beef, then we don't have to worry about the hormones.
Yeah, there would be no growth hormones in those. And growth hormones, are not transferable from, so there's no environmental contamination from one, from organic to from non-organic to organic. So you don't have to worry about that.
Okay, let me understand, how quickly are we actually growing a chicken? I mean, if a chicken is born today, when is he ready to be on the dinner table? I mean, how quickly are they fast-forwarding this process?
Boy, I forget. It's a matter of weeks, and I can't remember exactly the number of weeks anymore, but it's about 3 months, I think, as I recall.
Wow. So, from the time of being hatched to 3 months, he's on the table.
Yeah.
Wow. That's scary. I mean, because I've seen the 60-minute specials where they show the chickens. Chickens aren't grown on farms anymore and allowed to roam free. They're kind of like warehoused, and it's overcrowded, and so it's not a healthy condition, basically. And then you're taking and you're injecting it with a hormone, and it's basically ready to eat in 3 months. That's scary. I don't know. That's scary. If you're on the phone lines and have a question or a comment, press 1. Or if you're listening in via the Internet, dial us up at 347-850-8390. And, again, press 1. A reminder, the chat room is open tonight, so if you have a question or a comment, you can post it up in bold in chat. And I will pose a question to Dr. Amy Dean or Dr. Frederick Kirschman before the end of the show. So as far as cows are concerned, they're being injected with hormones as well. So when we see these cows today that are just huge, is that meat safe? You know, is that too big for a cow? If a cow is 1,000 pounds, is that too big for a cow to be, or should we? How do we know? I mean, how do we know what we're getting when we're eating our dinner? How do we know?
Well, if you go into the grocery store and buy a steak, you probably don't know. But you mentioned 1,000 pounds, which is not huge for a cow. The thing is, nature is always more complex than we would like to see it be. You know, we want to be able to manage it and control it, and so the big framed animals, which were introduced, about 25 years ago. And, everybody thought this was going to be so great because the animals, you have thicker calves and they would grow faster and therefore you'd be able to produce the meat more efficiently, et cetera, et cetera. And then what we began to discover was that the big framed animals didn't breed back as well. In terms of feed efficiency, the amount of feed which they ate for the growth of the animal, was not as good. And so, a lot of farmers gave up on the big framed animals because they just, you had all those unintended consequences that, they didn't think about when they were breeding them and developing them.
I understood when I was growing up that cows ate grass. Now we're not feeding cows grass anymore?
Yeah, well, again, I think one of the things we have to be careful of is to always blame somebody, blame the farmer or blame the company or blame the processor. But we've all participated in creating this food system that we have, and what you just mentioned is part of that. If you want your food cheap and you want it fast and you want it convenient, then everybody's going to gear up to do that. And we have to have some appreciation now. And I think that the important thing in this conversation is to not just target genetic engineering, because genetic engineering is a part of an industrial system that we've created. And that is, again, as I said earlier, maximum efficient production for short-term economic return. That's the single goal, and that's what everybody's going to do. And so now, you have farmers that have made huge investments. Farms aren't, 200-300 acres anymore. They're, 5,000, 10,000, some places 25,000 acres. Because they have followed that rule. And now they've made that investment, and now 30% of our farmers are over age 65, and now we're going to go to them and say, gee, we don't like what you did, and we don't like the food that's coming out of this, and we'd like you to do something different. Well, if you were 65 and you'd invested billions of dollars on what everybody told you they wanted you to do, to produce, to maximize efficient production, and that's what you did, would you say, okay, well, sure, tomorrow I'll change? And input suppliers and processing companies and retail stores are the same way.
But Dr. Kirschman, I understand the pressure to go along with what everybody's doing. However, I mean, I think if the American people had a choice, and I guess the people across the country had a choice as to whether we wanted it faster or cheaper or whether we wanted it safe, I think, that's a no-brainer.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have change in or that change won't come. I think change will definitely come. One of the primary reasons that change is going to come is because, you know, we say we have the most efficient food system in the world, and that's true from the point of view of labor efficiency, at least at certain levels, like on a farm. And we now, 75% of our total agriculture sales are now produced by just 192,442 farms in this country. So, you know, that's enormously efficient from a labor point of view, but it's one of the most intensive energy consuming systems. It's a very high energy system. And so as our energy costs go up, our food costs are going to go up. In fact, the United Nations issued a report here just a few weeks ago now in which they pointed out the relationship between the price of oil and the price of food. And the chart, the chart is amazing because as the price of oil went up, the price of food went up at exactly the same rate. And so at some point, the system's not going to work anymore because the era of cheap energy is over. And there are other things as well that are, you know, we're depleting our water resources, we're depleting our mineral resources, rock phosphate and potassium, all of which are a critical part of the system. So at some point, it's not going to work. All that I'm saying is that, you know, for us to go out and simply say to, you know, farmers or to input companies now and say, you know, we want you to change, you know, next year and do something different, it's not going to happen. What we need to do is prepare for the changes that are coming, and we need to do the research so that when this system doesn't work anymore, what's a system that is going to work? And fortunately, we have farmers all around the world, mostly small farmers, that have already made this transition. You know, they're very energy efficient because they have developed diverse biological systems in which the waste from one part of the system becomes the energy for another part, and they produce much more food per acre than the monocultures that we currently have. But we haven't done the research to how to adapt those systems in, you know, every part of the planet, which is one of the things we have to do.
Dr. Dean, your site mentioned what you thought or what you all thought physicians should be doing to educate the public. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think education for especially environmental medicine is a key for any health condition. And one thing that is very easy is for the medical community to start educating their patients about, you know, avoiding genetically modified foods and make them aware of health risks. And very simply, you know, avoiding, there are five now, the big five, the soy, corn, canola, cotton, cottonseed oil, and beets are the main genetically modified foods. And by just eliminating these from the diet, patients and actually your listeners can avoid the lion's share of genetically modified foods, and also avoid potentially at least a lot of the risk that we're seeing in the animal studies as far as liver degeneration, kidney degeneration, and a lot of the immune dysfunction and reproductive problems.
Wait a minute, you said corn, soy, and what?
Corn, soy, canola, cotton or cottonseed oil, and beets.
Really? Did not know that. We'll definitely write that down. Now, is it likely that physicians will get involved with this? I mean, because, you know, a lot of people say, you know, doctors, I mean, I hate to say this, they're not in the business of telling you how to get well. They're just in the business of putting a Band-Aid on what's your problem so that they stay employed. You know, it is just what it is. So do you think that they're ever going to tell people, well, don't do this and do that? And because wouldn't that put them out of business?
Well, you know, I think a lot of physicians are unfortunately driven at such a pace that they are not allowed the time to look for the cause of disease, so they're kind of trapped with using protocols and symptom treatment. So there are a lot of physicians out there who are seeing patients, and if you talk to most physicians, especially pediatricians or, you know, people who, docs who treat children, they'll tell you that children are getting much harder to treat, and it takes them a lot longer to get well. And so they're noticing it, and they want to know why. They want to know what's going on, too. And there are more and more physicians who are asking the question of what's the cause of all this, and there are groups of physicians who are beginning to come forward to support labeling and are very concerned about genetically modified foods' effects on health. So it's very encouraging.
So do we have any clues as to why that is? Why are children taking so long to heal?
That's the big question, and there's a lot of concern that it stems from environmental exposure, because that's the main thing that's changed over the last few years.
And going back to what I think I found, that, like you say, the 90s, the late 90s is when we first saw GM foods hit the market. Isn't that about the time we start seeing a rise in obesity and a rise in diabetes and diseases like that?
It was a cardiology conference. They showed a national map, and it may have been worldwide, I can't remember, of the incidence of diabetes from the early 90s through 2009, and the incidence really began to skyrocket after 1997, which is interesting because that's right around the time when the genetically modified foods were introduced. And that's also when you're going to start seeing high fructose corn syrup in the sodas and a lot of exposure to processed foods, which do often have, they say at least 70 to 80% of the time, have genetically modified foods in them. So there's a major justified concern that this is because the genetically modified foods were introduced about that same time.
Wow. Interesting stuff. When you buy your fresh fruits and vegetables, when you bring them home, what's the first thing you should do? Is there a way, seeing that they've been sprayed and everything else has been done to them, is there a certain way you should wash them before eating them? What should you be doing?
The Environmental Working Group, if listeners Google Environmental Working Group, I believe they have some pretty good lists as far as what vegetables are less contaminated with pesticides or have lower pesticide residues. When I see patients, we really, and a lot of the environmental physicians, we work really hard to try to make sure that they find a way to be able to eat organic, because when you're eating organic food, it's not really a luxury. It's more of a prescribed medical treatment for health. So it's very different. It's an expense. It's almost like, prescribing, instead of somebody a drug, you're actually prescribing them medicine. Food is medicine. So we work really hard to try to get them transferred over to organic foods and, whole foods and things like that are, much more healing. And just at a minimum, if they can only avoid those five foods, the genetically modified foods, that's a very big start that can be very beneficial to helping them heal.
I'm at a loss for words, because I'd never before tonight thought about buying organic, because I've always looked at it as being too expensive.
Absolutely.
First time, I'm thinking
it is more expensive. You're right.
I've just always looked at organic, and I see the difference in price, and I just never thought, okay, maybe that's just what I need to turn to. But after listening to you tonight, I am really going to rework my budget and think about, whether or not, that can happen, because it doesn't seem like, from what you all are saying, there's just been enough testing. I'm trying to understand what amount of testing was done before we decided to allow it on the market in the U.S.
Yeah, well,
have a year or two? Did we have 6 months? What kind of time frame are we looking at before they actually release these products on the market here in the U.S.?
Yeah, my understanding is there have been no human studies done, even though, there is animal data. I don't think there's any human data whatsoever, which, would never, ever happen if drugs were released onto the market. There's always research and careful planning and research that goes into things like that. And that's, it is an uncontrolled experiment.
So 0%. Wow, that's so scary. I'm trying to wrap my mind around that. So we just tested it on lab rats and saw what effects it had on them, and then we said, okay, good enough for humans, and we just started selling it to humans?
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure. I'm not sure kind of what the process was. Maybe Dr. Kirschman has a better idea of what has happened.
How did we get here?
And when you say how did we get here, meaning?
Meaning, just like I just asked, they tested in rats, determined, good enough for rats, so now good enough for humans, and then, suddenly we found it in our supermarkets?
Well, it's we basically operate on the principles of on the principle of not on the principle again of precaution, but on the principle of risk benefit analysis. And so, you know, if you can indicate that the benefit appears to be greater than the risk, you know, then you're basically allowed to to put it out on the market. And then if later on you discover that there are, you know, problems with it, well, then you pull it off of the market. And that's why I think, implementing the precautionary principle would be a much wiser approach. But, you know, there's so much resistance to that in this country that it's probably not going to happen in the near future.
Let a couple hundred thousand people die and then we say, okay, it's not safe?
Well, I don't know if you need to get to 100,000, but I don't know. I mean, the other problem is here, like, you don't smoke one cigarette and then you die in the street the next day. I mean, you know, it takes time for these things to materialize, and that's why it's you can never prove that something is safe. You can only prove when something is not safe. In order to prove that something, to absolutely prove that something is safe, you have to be sure that you have tested or asked every question that potentially could be, affect the safetiness of, which you never can do.
But if it's something that takes a long time to show its effects, and people coming from all different lifestyles, it will be harder to determine what actually took you out of here. You know, and let's just say if it caused your death. If you're a person who's a vegetarian and the other person isn't, but at the same time we ate maybe, the same vegetable, for a period of time, it's going to be hard to determine if it doesn't show up right away, right?
Well, I think that's where the animal studies come in too. You know, I mean, we're seeing different studies show the same patterns of immune disruption, liver problems, spleen problems. So, I think that's one reason it's important to look to the animal data is that it is such a controlled environment, even though we as humans are exposed to pollutants and pesticides and, all kinds of ambient pollution. In the animal studies, they're seeing very consistent, repeatable disease processes going on that we're also seeing in the humans. So,
I was just thinking, it maybe was around, I'm trying to remember where I was living at when I first heard the term mad cow disease. And then in recent years, every time we turn around, there's a food recall on lettuce or the peanut butter or something. Is this due to genetically modified foods? Or could it be, I should say, could it be connected to genetically modified foods? Either of you. Dead silence. but could it, really, because, there was a while back in the summer where every other week, there was a different vegetable being recalled, spinach one week, and then it was lettuce another week, and then it was something else another week. And it really got kind of scary because you really didn't know what to eat. And these were vegetables. Really, could it be connected?
Well, I think those recalls were things like E. coli and, other kinds of contaminants and I don't think that, as far as I know, there wasn't any direct correlation between those kinds of recalls and transgenic foods. One of the problems is that again because we've insisted on getting our food fast, convenient, and cheap, we have created these monstrous systems which are very difficult to control. All of the variables, and so you have these huge monocultures, which where you have a large number of animals in one place, which where some of the manure from the animals goes into the stream, and then downstream you have farmers taking water out of the stream to irrigate their vegetables. And so that has to do more again with the system that we've created rather than the specific technologies.
I guess my problem with it is, we didn't seem to have the recalls on foods prior to the genetically modified foods hitting the market.
Well, but again, we have to be very careful here because just because something happens simultaneously doesn't necessarily mean they're connected. You know, we have to establish that. I mean, there may be a connection, but we don't know just because it happened simultaneously.
Okay, and I agree with that. And Dr. Dean had to leave the conversation. She was only with us, y'all, for the first hour, and I so appreciated her for coming. She had another obligation tonight, so I really do appreciate her spending the first hour with us. But, you know, I guess what I'm trying to understand is when you have a government that's responsible for its people and the food supply, you would think, for the most part, that their main focus would be to make sure that the food was safe for the people. So why do you think it is that no human testing would have been done if that is the case? I mean, because if I were running the government and I was, you know, over the USDA and the FDA, I would make certain that the food supply was safe.
Well, unfortunately, you know, we are finding ourselves in a situation now where there is so much pressure on politicians from vested interests and with campaign funding, et cetera, that, a number of my friends have indicated we really don't have a functioning democracy anymore, and I think to a large extent that's correct. Because you've got this enormous amount of money into the system now, which basically makes the decisions of what gets done or doesn't get done, and I think that's going to change. I think that the whatever you think of the Occupy movement, it's part of the civic unrest of people being dissatisfied with this, and they want to see our democracy restored again. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have to see how it all plays out. But I think that's, it's not that we don't have the rules in place or that we don't have a government. We have a government. It's just that it doesn't really respond to all of the needs of the general public. It responds to the people that fund their campaigns.
Someone is asking you in the chat room, Dr. Hirschman. They said, I have been getting a lot of flack for eating organic the last 7 years and for raising my 3.5-year-old son organic. What would you tell someone who thinks it's okay to feed my son GMOs and non-organic food?
Well, when you get into those kinds of conversations with neighbors, it's always difficult to know exactly what motivates people. Even though I am an organic farmer, I don't necessarily think that organic is the answer to everything. I think as you had mentioned earlier, that it does give you a certain kind of choice in the marketplace that has certain kinds of benefits. We now have a lot of organic farms, which are very large monocultures, and they're simply using natural inputs instead of synthetic inputs. They're not attending to the restoration of the biological health of soil and those other kinds of things, which really give you the major benefit to organic food. So I think we have to be careful about, saying this is all good and that's all bad. It's not the world that we live in. But I do think that choosing organic foods, given what's out there and given the options that people have, for the most part, makes sense. And I also want to go back a little bit to the cost issue because. The cheap food claim to a large extent is a myth because we claim we have the cheapest food in the world, and the metric that we use for that is that we spend less of our average disposable income on food than any other country, and that's true, a little bit less than 10% now. but our average disposable income is also so much higher than it is in most other countries that it really isn't. It really doesn't tell us anything about the real cost of food. And I made that point to a friend of mine, Chuck Benbrook, who's the chief scientist for the Organic Center. And I made that point with him a few years ago. I said, you know, we got to come up with a different metric. And he said, yeah, we should. So he went to work and did a study to determine the cost of food per calorie, the cost per calorie. And what he found using that metric is that we, the United States, is actually 23rd on the list. There are 22 countries that have cheaper food on a cost per calorie basis. But then I told Chuck, I said, there's still the wrong metric because you could have food that's very high in calories but low in nutrient value, and so it still doesn't tell you anything about the real cost of food. What we need is the cost of food per nutrient value. And he said, yeah, that's right, but that's more complex, which, of course, it is. But you know, when you look at it, you know, we go into the store and we look at the cost of food in terms of the cost per quantity, the cost per ounce rate. Mm-hmm. And what we really ought to be doing is going into the store and looking at the cost per nutrient value. And, you know, and there have not been a lot of studies. There was a study actually done in Europe a number of years ago where they tracked two families, one family that bought almost all organic food and one family that bought almost all conventional food. And they followed them for a month and then calculated how much each spent. And the family that bought almost all organic food, despite the fact that the cost of the food per ounce was much higher, they actually spent about the same as the conventional family.
Really?
And the reason was because they bought food which was more nutrient-dense, and so they ate less. So they bought less quantity, even though they paid more, you know, per quantity.
Hmm.
And the thing is, and I think, you know, we talked quite a bit tonight about obesity. I happen to think that the cause of obesity has much more to do with the fact that we eat such large quantities of highly processed food, which mostly is high in calorie and low in nutrient value, and so you eat more of it because you're not satisfied, and so you eat until you're full. And whereas if you eat food that's nutrient dense, you eat until you're satisfied, and so you eat less quantity, and that would be a bigger contribution to dealing with the obesity problem, I think, than most anything else.
You know, you talked a lot tonight about the fact that, you know, we as consumers want things faster, cheaper, and more efficient. But how much would our food supply suffer if we did away with GM foods tomorrow?
Well, you know, the disadvantage initially would be to farmers who are now locked into a very specialized monoculture system, and especially when you look at a crop like soybeans, which has to have good weed control. And if you suddenly took Roundup Ready soybean seeds out of the equation, it would be extremely difficult for them to make that adjustment because they are now so dependent on being able to manage those huge acreages in a short period of time. And so they need that simplification of management. And so being able to plant those soybeans and wait until the weeds come up and then spray it with Roundup and your soybeans are fine and the weeds are dead, you know, and that's it would be very difficult for them to adjust to a system where they have to, you know, go to a more complex weed management system.
Well, we had Roundup before genetically modified foods hit the market, right?
Yeah, but farms before Roundup came on the marketplace, farms tended to be much smaller because farmers knew they couldn't manage 5,000 acres of soybeans, so they were more like, you know, probably having 500 acres of soybeans. Mm-hmm. And now they've made the investment and they locked into these larger acreage systems, and then it becomes very difficult. This is why when our weed scientist at Iowa State University said to farmers they're going to have to change their weed control strategy because they simply just use Roundup, then it's going to become, you know, two more years and they're not going to be able to use it anymore. But you know, once you're now locked into this system where you got these huge acreages to cover and you got to control the weeds on it, it's really extremely difficult for them to. You know, there's also been some incredible research that's been done, and Matt Liebman at Iowa State University has got 8 years of research now, in which he simply looked at, okay, so we got this highly specialized system. It's just corn and beans. Suppose that we had a system that was a three-crop rotation. You had corn and beans, and then you had a small grain with sweet clover. And the sweet clover, of course, is a legume which fixes nitrogen in the soil, and then you use that clover as a green manure, and you incorporate that into soil, and it enriches the soil, and you add modest amounts of livestock manure. Or you had a four-year rotation where you had corn and beans and then a small grain and alfalfa, again, which is a legume, and then a second year of alfalfa. What would be the difference? Well, what he discovered, that if you had that 3 or 4 year rotation, you could reduce your pesticide use by 97%, you could reduce your fertilizer input by over 90%, and your return to land and labor would actually be slightly higher than the 2 year rotation.
So why doesn't our government know this?
Well, so I've talked to some farmers, and I said, you got all these advantages, why wouldn't you do that? What's the first thing the farmer's going to tell you? I said, what the hell am I going to do with the alfalfa? I can't take it to a local elevator and sell it. And he's right. You know, the market demands them to produce as much corn and beans as possible because that's what the market wants.
Are there any implications for rights of farmers to their own crops?
For the rights?
Yes. Like intellectual property?
Yeah, I mean, farmers can grow anything they want, I mean, as long as it's legal.
Okay.
I mean, as we all know, there's a few crops that aren't legal, so.
Exactly. I guess, you know, this whole debate, it just doesn't seem like there was enough discussion with the public before it just went out there, because I don't even remember anybody ever mentioning genetically modified foods back in the late 90s. So did they just put it on the market and, I mean, you're a farmer, you probably knew about it, but did the general public know in 1996 that genetically modified foods were hitting the market?
Well, I'm trying to remember, I don't recall that there was a lot of publicity around it. I mean, this was another technology, and farmers have new technologies that come along all the time, and they either decide to adopt.
But you say a new technology, but a new technology that was not tested on humans, but it's going to be humans that are eating it.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things. There are a lot of technologies that farmers adopt, and this is again where the biotech industry convinced FDA that it was a substantially equivalent product, and so then it took testing off the shelf. You didn't have to test if it was substantially equivalent.
See, something just really scary about that. I mean, it almost seems like there was a hush-hush on that, though. I mean, seriously, because if you told me back in 96 that you could take an orange and grow a kiwi inside, I think I'd want to know that.
Well, sure. I mean, I absolutely agree with you about that. I think there should have been much more transparency, et cetera. But, you know, that's not how our market functions. I mean, if you want to introduce a new technology, you want to make that as acceptable as possible. You want the public to buy as much of it as possible, and you'll do everything you can to make that happen.
You're a farmer, and your farm, like I said, is 2,600 acres. Tell me this: how many farmers have you known that went under since GM products hit the market?
Well, I don't know that anybody's done that exact correlation, but we've been losing farmers, since the 1940s at a dramatic rate, and mostly it's been the farmers in that middle category. I mean, the very small farmers' numbers are increasing, and the very large farmers' percentages are increasing. It's the mid-sized farmers that we've been losing. I mean, in that, we do the Ag Census data every 5 years, and in that 5-year period between 1997 and 2002 census, we lost 14.5% of the farmers in our country that were between $50,000 and $500,000 gross sales. And at the same time, we had, as I recall, about a 20% increase in the farmers that were below $5,000 in gross sales, and something like a 30% increase in farmers that were over $500,000 in gross sales. And, you know, the usual story around that is that the mid-sized farmers are not as efficient as the big farmers, and that's why we're losing them. And Mike Duffy, who's an ag economist at Iowa State University, was suspicious about that, and so he actually did a study on real farms in Iowa several years ago. And what he discovered was that farmers in Iowa, say a typical corn-soybean farmer in Iowa, actually reaches its peak efficiency at about 600 to 900 acres, which, you know, everybody would agree is a kind of a mid-sized family farm. And in hog production, a producer that produces about 1,200 hogs per year reaches its peak efficiency. So it's not a matter of efficiency. And I never really understood then why it was, if the mid-sized farmers were actually the more efficient ones, why were we losing them? And I didn't understand that fully until, this was a number of years ago, I was in a meeting and happened to sit next to one of the main meat marketers from Cargill. And when he found out who I was with the Leopold Center, he was curious, and he said, so what do you think is the future of family farms? And I said, well, if we don't do anything different than we're doing it now, you know, give it another 10 years and most of them are going to be gone. And he said, I think you're right. And he said, well, what about the big farms? And I said, well, as long as they continue to get bigger and learn to operate on thinner margins, they'll be okay, but eventually they'll be in trouble too. And then he turned to me and he said, I think you're right. As a matter of fact, we can't make a profit selling to Walmart anymore.
Really?
And I turned to him. I said, wait a minute, you're Cargill. And he said, yeah, but you don't understand how it works. And he wasn't targeting Walmart. He was talking about, you know, the big the concentration at the retail level. He said, when a retail store like Walmart needs a new product, they will come to us, namely those companies like Cargill that can produce that product at the scale that they need it, and they will say, here's a new product that we need. Give us your best price. So none of us want to lose an account of that size, and so we all sharpen our pencils and try to give them the best price we can and still have a reasonable return for ourselves. And then they'll select three of us, and they'll come back to us and say, now give us your real price.
Wow.
And so he said, what that forces us to do, he said, we don't want to lose that account. So the only way that we can get that account and reduce our price even more is to reduce our transaction costs. And he said one of the simplest ways of doing that is to only buy from the biggest farmers because, as he put it, he said it's cheaper for us to buy 10,000 hogs from one farmer than it is to buy 1,000 hogs from 10 farmers, so that's what we have to do. And there was the answer to my question. That's why we're losing the mid-sized farms.
Wow. And that's not even fair. But, you know, Walmart, I mean, in all fairness, has driven a lot of companies out of business.
Well, that's the way business is done now. You know, we don't feature competition anymore. What we feature is dominate and crush. You know, you want to crush your competition. That's the way business is done now in the food business. That's what getting bigger means.
You know, I was just thinking of the last time I was in a supermarket. I don't ever recall seeing anything labeled genetically modified food. So is there no labeling on anything?
No, it's not. There's no labeling about that.
Wow. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, that is really crazy. So, I mean, you know, it is weird because when you taste food now compared to, and I don't know when, I can't even, you know, put a finger on when it began to change, food doesn't even seem to taste the same anymore. It's kind of more bland than it was before, whether that be meat or vegetables or fruit. Do you think that may be due to genetically modifying?
Well, I don't know any studies that have verified that, but there are all kinds of other reasons why food's not rich in taste. And the primary one is the fact that we're not doing anything about the health of our soil. You know, I'm working with some chefs now who are, of course, very conscious about taste. Well, all chefs are conscious about taste. Mm-hmm. But there are really two schools of chefs now. There's what my friends who are chefs call the molecular chefs. they're the chefs who, they don't pay much attention to where the food comes from. They put all their effort into manipulating the food, you know, adding flavors, et cetera, to get it to the kind of taste that they want. And then the other school of chefs are what are called the farm-to-table chefs. They're the ones who spend all of their time finding farmers who are willing to manage their soil in ways that restore the biological health of the soil to get that rich soil that then produces that quality of plants that they want, the quality of food that they want, so that all they have to do is prepare the food in a way that allows the natural flavors to express themselves. And there's a world of difference. If you've ever eaten at a restaurant that's a farm-to-table chef, you know the difference. I mean, that's the best-tasting food you'll ever taste in your life. And
I'm sure the cost is significantly higher.
Well, you know, most of these happen to be upscale restaurants, yeah. But again, it's if you want to eat at one every night, it's going to be pricey. But if you want to, you know, take your sweetheart on a night that's a real special night, and you know, it's a place to go.
Well, you know what? For somebody who may be listening who is a little concerned now about what they're eating, you know, is farming, for someone who's been doing it for a while, is farming hard to do if someone decided that they just wanted to put a farm, a garden on their property and grow their own foods? Is that hard to do, or is that something that is not made for everybody? Because I'm now concerned that maybe I ought to try my hand at just doing my own garden, and then I'll know what I'm getting.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I think one of the things, again, given the kind of challenges we're going to see in the future, in fact, we're already seeing, there's a dramatic increase in gardening right now. There's some friends of mine who are in the business of selling garden seeds, and for the last 3 years they've been telling they haven't been able to keep up with the demand because there's more demand than they can keep seeds, you know, in the store. You know, we've had four periods in our history when we've had this emergence of gardening. The first time was in the late 1800s, and it was precipitated by an economic depression. And back then, potatoes were a staple for most people, and so it was actually the mayor of Detroit that coined the phrase potato patch. And potato patches became enormously popular, and there were like millions of them, you know, by the time that depression ended, and then the gardening kind of receded again. And then the second time was during the First World War, and we called them Liberty Gardens. And then, of course, it was the human capital which was lacking because the men were all off the war, and the gardening was a movement primarily developed by women. But again, there were millions of Liberty Gardens during that period of time. And then the third time was during the Depression of the 1930s, and we call them relief gardens. And again, was precipitated by, you know, where people didn't have the money, and so they started growing their own food. And then the fourth time was during the Second World War, which was the Victory Garden movement. And Eleanor Roosevelt planted a Victory Garden in the White House lawn. And, of course, Michelle Obama is aware of that history. And so we're starting to see this movement now, and it's coming back again. And by 1949, half of our fresh vegetables in this country were grown in Victory Gardens.
Really?
Right. And I think that you're going to see. In fact, Richard Heinberg, who's written several books about energy, and he claims that by 2040. We're going to have 40 to 50 million people engaged in producing food in this country.
And I don't blame them, because I think I'm going to be one of them. You mentioned that you had a friend that sold seed. My question is there a such thing as organic seed? And if so, can you get it? And third question, to piggyback off that, is there a such thing as organic seed today?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are several companies. There's a organic seed company in Albert Lea, Minnesota, for example. It's a fairly large company, and they just specialize on organic seeds. There's a friend of mine in North Dakota by the name of Blaine Schmaltz, who's a small farmer, but he's primarily engaged in producing organic seeds. Now, when you ask the question, is the seed organic? And if you're asking, is that seed free of any kind of genetic material? In it,
yes.
The answer to that is if it's a seed of a plant that has a genetically modified counterpart like corn, there is very likely in the seed going to be some trace amounts of those genetic materials. That's a really interesting question to ask. You know, what the requirement on the part of the organic standard is that if you're going to be certified organic, you cannot use genetically modified seeds, in your production. But it doesn't require you to test the seed that has been produced organically to see if it has any trace amounts in it or not. So I would say it's as a matter of fact, on our farm, we used to raise canola, and we had to give up raising it because, I wanted to always make sure that there wasn't any contamination. And when Roundup Ready canola, came into North Dakota, and it's, of course, an insect-pollinated crop, and there was simply no way anymore to create the kind of boundary between my neighbor's canola and ours, to keep it pure. And we got to a point where we couldn't find seed, because we tested the seed. We couldn't find seed anymore that wasn't contaminated, so we just gave it up in the rotation.
And see, that's what I'm really, because the whole thing about organic is a tricky question, because I was told by someone who has a small garden that organic seed was nearly impossible to find.
Well, again, like I say, it depends on what you mean by organic seed. If you simply mean certified organic seed,
what you describe, has it been altered in any way?
Yeah, if you mean that it has no trace amounts of a genetically engineered material, then in terms of corn and soybeans and canola and cotton, it probably would be pretty difficult to find. Yeah, it'd be very small trace amounts, but there'd be some trace amounts there.
That, and this was mind blowing for me, with them genetically altering these plants, that they can never reproduce more than one harvest. I mean, they can't produce more than one harvest. Is that so? That you can't take this.
You can't see if you buy Roundup Ready seed, you cannot use the seed from your harvest to plant your next crop, because it's patented, and so you have to buy seed every year, right?
But that wasn't always the case, was it?
Well, it's always been the case with genetically engineered seed. Yeah, it's not obviously not always been the case in terms of farmers traditionally always used to save their own seed, but when you buy a patented seed, you can't.
So that changed, as they say, the game a whole bunch.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And Monsanto has sued hundreds of farmers, even when farmers at least claimed they didn't intentionally seed the patented seed, but it had drifted into their fields, but they tested them for it, and then still they still get sued for it.
So is Monsanto winning these lawsuits?
Oh yes, as far as I know, they've won all of those lawsuits.
Wow.
Because the farmers don't have the money to stand up against Monsanto's lawyers.
Wow.
So they just settle out of court for the most part.
This thing is like, wow, bigger than I even thought. Because I can't imagine that the public would have agreed to, if we knew ahead of time that we thought genetically modified food was a good thing, if we couldn't even take our seed and reproduce a second harvest from it. That means the cost to farmers just significantly skyrocketed when we changed the system.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, and the cost of seed has gone up dramatically for farmers. In fact, one of the jokes in Iowa now is, there's a genetically engineered seed, which is a combination, which is called SmartStack. And the joke is that the SmartStack seeds are now so expensive, it's finally making the farmer smart.
Well, let me ask you a personal question. You can choose to answer or not answer it. How do you stay above water with all the changes that we're seeing? I mean, what's your secret?
Well, it's first of all, it's a question of whether we're staying above water. But the biggest challenge for us on our farm right now is climate. know, we had just this, our crop in 2011 was one of the poorest crops we've had in the last 25 years because, you know, ours is a relatively arid area, and so we grow crops which are adapted to those kinds of conditions. And ever since records have been kept in central North Dakota, where our farm is, we've had 14 inches of moisture a year. And this year, by the end of November, we had 40 inches. And so, you know, we first of all, we couldn't get into our field, so we were 5 weeks late getting planting. So we were late in planting. And then soils were waterlogged, so the plants didn't do well. And then we had, because of all of the moisture, we had some fungus problems. So we had vomitoxin in our wheat. So some of our wheat's not even saleable for human consumption. So those are huge, you know, economic problems that we have to absorb. And so, you know, this is why, you know, the kinds of challenges that farmers are facing now is not only increased costs because of increased energy costs, and it's going to be farmers who rely on synthetic fertilizers like, you know, potash and phosphorus, which because those mineral resources also are being depleted, so those costs are going up. And then you got more unstable climates, you know. So we're going to have to really rethink, you know, our whole food and farming system to adapt to these new circumstances. And we're in the process of doing that on our own farm. We're gonna reinvent our farm. We're one of the things about our farm, you know, about 1,000 acres of our farm is still a native prairie, which we use for grazing our livestock. And the native prairie did fine through all of this time. The livestock did fine. It was the annual crops which didn't do fine. So I think we're going to make some adjustments in our system.
I know that they can make plants drought resistant. But what do you do for flooding? Once you flood it, it's gone, right? You've lost it, or you had like a hard freeze on your crops. They're gone, right? There's no.
Yeah, this is, you know, again, this is one of the fallacies around you know, the development of technology. You know, you figure that, you know, if you just develop drought resistant crops, then somehow you're going to be adapted to climate change. Well, you know, what climatologists are telling us, we're going to have more unstable climates, that we're going to have more droughts and more floods. So, and the other thing, even with drought-resistant crops and drought-resistant seeds, whether you develop that drought resistance through genetic engineering or through natural breeding, you know, more drought resistance is probably not a bad thing to have if it doesn't have other intended consequences that come with it. But you know, it's not going to, you still, even with a drought-resistant plant, you still need moisture in the soil. And, you know, if we really paid attention to restoring the biological health of soil, you know, some research had been done, for example, if soil has 1% organic matter, which is one metric for determining its health, then soil has the capacity to absorb and retain about 33 pounds of water per cubic yard. If you have 5% organic matter, it's 195 pounds. So you could theoretically reduce your need for irrigation by a factor of 6 by improving, you know, biological health of soil from 1% to 5%. Now, you can't improve all soil to 5% because it depends on what you start with as your basic soil formation. But you can improve the organic matter of soil in all soils to some extent. But the reason we haven't done any of this is because energy was cheap, you know, rock phosphate was cheap, potassium was cheap. So it was cheaper to just insert these inputs into the soil rather than dealing with the job of restoring the biological health of soil. But I think if there's one thing that we should really concentrate on and attend to as we deal with these challenges in the future, to restoring the biological health of soil all across the planet would be one of the most important things to do.
I agree with you 100%. One thing I found out from researching for this show is that, you know, if you want to say there are advantages to genetically modified foods, they say that there's the fact that they're pest resistant, they're herbicide tolerant, they're disease resistant, they're cold tolerant, they're drought tolerant, the nutritional value and the pharmaceutical value. Would you agree with that?
That genetically engineered crops provide all those benefits? Is that what you're
right? That's what I found. And I was like, really? But that's what I found, that those were the advantages to genetically modified foods.
Well, I don't know of any variety of any of crops that has all of those, you know, benefits engineered into them. And the other thing is, you know, what we're finding is one of the major problems that I see with this technology is that it's, again, single tactic approaches. So if you just insert this gene. And we had the same thing in healthcare, you know, and in healthcare, and many of my friends are in healthcare, and so I'm learning some things from them. They're telling me now, you know, you used to hear people in healthcare, well, if we just find the gene that causes heart disease and we modify that gene, and then we'll have solved the problem. You don't hear healthcare professionals saying that anymore, because we now know that the genome is not fixed, and it's now the concept of epigenetics, that genes turn on and off depending on the environment, and et cetera. So it's a much more complex factor, and that's why we have to deal in both in agriculture and healthcare. We have to deal with managing systems to maintain and sustain health, and systems that reduce pest pressure, instead of trying to fix it with a technology. And there's been some research now in the July 1st one issue of Nature magazine, and now had some peer-reviewed research which demonstrated that fields that were managed, in this case organically, but it was managed organically as an agroecological system, that is, as a, you know, managing the system in terms of its biological diversity, over against a field that was managed conventionally, using conventional therapies. And what they found was that in the conventional field, when you had a pest emergence and you came in with a pesticide, you would reduce it on the short term, but then the pest would reemerge again in a relatively short period of time. Where in the organic fields, which were managed in terms of trying to maintain the diversity of the biology of the system, that you had some pests, but that it was the diversity, what they called biological evenness, which kept the pests in check through the whole growing season, so that you actually had less pest damage in the organic field than you had in the conventional field. Those are the kinds of things that we ought to do. How do we manage? And this is what Joe Lewis in the article which I mentioned earlier, he and his colleagues published a paper in the National Academy of Sciences Proceedings back in 1997. And they finally boiled it. And they made this statement based on their experience in pest management over 50 years, that this single tactic therapeutic intervention approach, where you come in with a pesticide to get rid of the pest, was not sustainable for the reasons that I mentioned. And then they said, what we need to do is to give up the single tactic therapeutic intervention and instead go to natural systems management. How do you manage systems? And they finally boiled it down to a simple issue. They said, instead of asking, how do I get rid of the pest, we ought to be asking, why is the pest a pest? And if you approach it that second way, you're going to look at the system and what's wrong with the system that causes pests to emerge, and you change the way you manage the system so that you manage in ways that has that biological evenness, which then nature keeps the pests in check. Now, that doesn't mean that sometimes you may not have a pest emergence as you do in nature, and you may have to then use a pesticide in that one occasion. But that's not how you manage, you know, the system on the whole. You manage it so that it's basically self-regulating.
You know, I one thing comes to mind is when someone, say, has a heart transplant, it has been said that if, you know, the person had not been tested, let's just say for HIV, then that disease is then transferred to the person that received the new heart.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you would wonder, with all of the genetically modifying of these different plants, when you're taking one gene, if you will, and you know, from one thing, and you're putting it somewhere else, are you certain that you're not also transferring something else?
Well, I'm not a specialist in this, so I couldn't tell you. I would think you'd have the potential for that maybe, but I would I guess I'm just going to assume that the people that are doing this technology would be more would be cautious enough about to make sure that isn't happening. But I don't know. I can't answer that question because I don't know.
And to me, it's a fair question, though, but because if you've only tested it in rats and not done any testing on humans, the answer is we don't know. No one knows if it has not been tested on humans. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Well, but we're not talking now about genetically engineering humans. We're talking about humans eating food that's been genetically engineered. And personally, I don't eat any processed food because processed food is not nutritious. And if I don't eat processed food, I know I'm not eating genetically engineered food because I think there are a lot of uncertainties that we don't know because we haven't done the kind of comprehensive testing that would give us the assurance. But beyond that, I don't know how to answer your question because it's a very complex situation.
Okay, someone in the chat room posed a good question. They said, you know, what about the cloning of meat? Remember back a while back we started hearing about, I forgot the sheep's name, but, you know, the cloning. Has any of that reached our dinner table yet?
My understanding is that there is, that in some of the cloning experiments that they've done, that meat has gone into the marketplace, but I think it's pretty limited at this point.
Now that's gross. We knew way back when it happened that eventually that would happen, but I think they kind of played it down in the media that it wasn't going to be a big deal and it was just kind of all experimental and they just wanted to see that they could do it. But do you think cloning is safe for our meat?
Well, we don't know because there hasn't been the kind of rigorous testing that's required. To me again, the critical issue here is what are we actually trying to accomplish with this? Because one of the things that we have done essentially for basically three centuries now, is ignored the free ecosystem services that nature provides, and we have not paid attention to maintaining the health of those gifts. You know, Bob Costanza, economist, back in 1997, published an article in Nature magazine in which he pointed out that 75% of our gross domestic product comes from the free services of nature. So 75 cents out of every dollar that we generate comes from gifts of nature, and we have not paid attention to preserving and maintaining the health of those, soil and biodiversity, and we're starting to experience the cost of that now. When, the loss of bees, we don't even know for sure exactly, but it has something to do with the way in which we're managing nature and the loss of bees, the loss of bats. These are going to be enormous costs now, which farmers are going to have to pay in terms of, more pollination and more insect control, which the bats were doing before. So, eventually I think we're going to learn the lessons that if we put as much of our creative energy into preserving the natural capital, which stands behind everything that we want to do and that we want to achieve as humans, then that would be much more important use of our brain power than, creating these technologies for manipulating the genes of particular organisms.
I found in my research that they say, according to the FDA, that is, that there are over 40 plant varieties that have completed all of the federal requirements for commercialization. And if they have not tested this stuff on humans, what kind of requirements are we talking about?
Yeah, and that's worrisome. And this is why I think that we have an opportunity now, as I said earlier, that we have an opportunity now that we're talking about genetically engineering whole foods to insist on the labeling. Because if you're going to go into a store and you're going to buy broccoli for your three-year-old, you're going to want to know, because maybe it's all safe, but it's, maybe it's not, and you don't know, and you're not going to want to buy it for your child. You're going to want to buy. You want to know that it's labeled so you can buy something that's not engineered in that way. And I think then that with Whole Foods now being engineered, I think we have an opportunity to get the labeling thing done.
I just find it absolutely fascinating that, you know, we're having this discussion tonight, but to my knowledge, I've never heard this conversation on mainstream media or this dialogue on mainstream media, which is scary because, first of all, that tells me there's probably a portion of our population who doesn't even understand genetically modified foods, and then secondly, they don't even know that they're eating it, which doesn't really seem fair. Like you said, with no labeling, no testing on humans, it just doesn't seem like our government has been fair. Other governments are speaking out about it and banning it. So that, to me alone, says there may be a potential problem.
Yeah, and again, I think that we had the USDA and the Justice Department a little over a year ago decided that they were going to address the problem of lack of competition in the meat industry. And so they held meetings all around the country. There were farmers and others that testified at these, and everybody was in agreement that we needed to do something about this. And then when it got right down to implementing the rules that were developed in order to protect competition, the meat industry came down on USDA like a ton of bricks, and they backed away, and basically, you know, we didn't get anything out of it. So, you know, this is the problem with lack of competition and concentration, and with increased concentration, because you increase power. And you know, I don't want to be necessarily critical of, you know, companies who've made huge investments. They want to obviously protect their investment for their shareholders, and so they're going to do everything they can to try to get the government to do what they want it to do in their interest. But that's not what democracy is about, and so we got a huge problem there that I think is actually a much more problem than particularly technologies.
You know, one of the things that Marco Cantiro, I'm sorry, said this morning that was mind-blowing is that in the world we have 1 billion obese, but yet we have 1 billion starving. So, you know, genetically modifying food obviously is not fixing, you know, the whole problem. So I asked him, I said, well, how do you think, you know, the problem could be fixed? And his answer was that first we had to acknowledge it, and then we had to see who was driving it. And basically who's benefiting from it. And then he said use public money, basic economic research. And then he went on to say consumption patterns. We needed to monitor closely consumption patterns. And then he went on to say, which I found interesting, he said trying to change the mindsets of people. I don't know if that's easy to do. I mean, but, you know, that's one of the things that he mentioned. And he also said that food aid didn't work. He didn't feel like that was actually helping. You know, there were actually still people starving, and food aid was not working. So those were some of the things that he said needed to be fixed.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that the United Nations over the last 10 years has come out with, I don't know, 8 or 9 reports, all of which essentially said, you know, basically the same thing. And by these reports, I mean reports about how we deal with our food security problems. And they all said essentially the same thing. And that is, you know, the first report was called Agriculture at the Crossroads. Which basically said that we're now at a crossroads, and the industrial model of, you know, producing as much as possible, using technologies, et cetera, was not going to solve the world's problems, because the farmers in developing countries who are mostly small farmers who are operating on very, very thin margins, they can't afford the kind of technologies, et cetera, that the industrial world has. So simply transferring the technologies developed in the industrial world, you know, to the developing world is not going to work. That doesn't mean that some technologies probably aren't useful, but what we have to do, they said, was to work with farmers in their own communities, in their own culture, help them to restore the biological health of their soil and make the resources available that they can produce food for their own people in their own communities. And essentially, and then there was the there was another report called Agroecology and the Right to Food, which essentially said the same thing. And they in fact pointed out that small farmers using agroecological principles could double the amount of food that they produced. And then there was another program about waste and how much food that we're wasting. You know, we're already producing enough food to feed 9 billion people, but we're wasting about a third of it. And the other thing is that we're the billion people who currently are going hungry, when we say we're feeding the world, are going hungry not because enough food is being produced, but because they're going hungry because of poverty. They can't afford the food. They can't get access to the food. So we've got a number of issues that we have to deal with. And again, to me, the biggest problem in trying to promote this notion that all we got to do is develop these technologies and then we're going to feed the world and solve all the problems, it so distorts the picture of the actual problems we have to deal with, and it's therefore not going to solve the problems. And that, to me, is the biggest problem.
Wow. Well, guys, we got to get out of here. This has been a very interesting conversation about genetically modified foods. Are they killing you? I'd like to say thank you to my guest tonight, Dr. Amy Dean, who was with us for the first hour. She is the president of the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. And also we had with us Dr. Fred.